you. Let's see. I want to thank the organizers for inviting me. I also want to thank various deities for having the plane land yesterday. Apparently that was far from trivial. I'm staying at the Days Inn, which is about a 20-minute walk from here. Some people just laughed. They are probably staying on the 6th or 7th or 8th floor of the Days Inn as well. We got a 3 a.m. Fire alarm at the Days Inn. At first, I didn't think the organizers had anything to do with this, but now I'm not so sure anymore. Okay, I'll talk about the ABLE Transform. This is joint work with Matt Patterson, who's a student at the University of Washington. So what will I say? You'll hear about a lot of things. You'll hear about Riemann theta functions. You'll hear about Riemann surfaces, ABLE transforms, and Riemann constants, and much more. Why should you care? I don't know, but I'll tell you why I care. Here's some pictures from water waves. I wish I had some of these bigger. This is a rather famous picture. It's often used to illustrate the interaction of two-dimensional solitons. Actually, one-dimensional solitons having a two-dimensional interaction right there. It's a picture taken off the coast of Oregon. I want to point out that beyond this, there seems to be something else over there and something else over there that seems to be coming in. The second picture right here is from a National Geographic of 1933. I want to ignore these small bombers and also ignore these wind ripples. What I want to focus on are these rather large shallow water waves that are propagating in this direction, so they're essentially one-dimensional waves. So the caption actually describes it very well, the caption from the National Geographic. These waves look a lot like what a typical elliptic function looks like. They have very sharp peaks and then very wide troughs. Now, they are still one-dimensional. You could have more complicated patterns. These are from a controlled experiment, laboratory experiments done by these people, Joe Hammack and collaborators. Here you see very clean hexagonal patterns. These are stationary, meaning that if you move along with the wave, nothing changes. And they could also have non-symmetric patterns, which you see here. Okay, these are also waves in shallow water. Here is an uncontrolled experiment. This is the coast of Long Island right there. If you're on this beach, the only thing you see is this white stuff. If you're in a plane very high up, you can see more, and you see these structures, and if you're on my side, you see hexagons. And, well, you can see anything you want. So those were, I would call them relatively clean hexagons. Here are, I'll leave the picture like this so you can read the caption. Actually, the picture should be like this. This is North Carolina. And this is a picture taken near Duck, North Carolina, where the Army Corps of Engineers has been taking wave observation data for decades now. And actually, during one of the recent hurricanes, I saw a picture of Duck, North Carolina on the news. So they have a pier there, and so I recognize the pier on the news. What I want to point out that for the willing observer, there are still remnants of huge hexagons here. This right there is a four-lane highway. Okay. So this hexagon gets interrupted here, but I would say this looks like it's a few hundred meters. So this was in the middle of a violent windstorm, and somebody who works at Carl Miller, who works at Duck, decided to go up in a small plane and take this picture, which we really appreciate. Yesterday was absolutely nothing. I should also say that's the last thing I'll say about water waves. So the long-term goal is I want to be able to describe these things, and the short of the matter is I'm not there yet. but I'll tell you where I am. So here's the equation that I want to believe describes a lot of the ways that you just saw. It's the KP equation. So it's a two-dimensional generalization of the KdV equation. Here's the two-dimensionality. It describes waves in shallow water that are weakly two-dimensional. That's why X and Y don't show up in the same way. The waves have to be long compared to the depth of water. The amplitude has to be small compared to the depth. And the waves have to be irrotational and inviscous. Okay? So, clearly, I lied. I'll show you this water wave again. Clearly, KP does not apply to this situation. This is all white water, and KP does not apply. But the beauty of asymptotics is that you use it to get something that's valid in a certain regime, and then often, more often than not, things work remarkably well way beyond the regime where you've derived your model. And so we can only be happy. Now, the KP equation has many remarkable properties, one of which is that it has solutions that are described by this formula. So some constant plus two derivatives of a log of this symbol theta here that depends linearly on this on x, y, and t, and then on this phase variable, and then that's this function theta is parameterized by this matrix B. Okay, let me keep that on the side. That's the one I'll give you most details about. If you don't care about KP, but you care about Sine-Gordon or KdV or any other integrable system, finite dimensional discrete, all of them have solutions that can be expressed using this theta function and using the Riemann surfaces that I'll be talking about. So yes, integrable systems are special, but on the other hand, all of them have solutions that can be described in this way. All right, let me start by explaining what all these symbols in here are. Let's start with theta. What is theta? There's a theta function right there. Well, here it is. It's a g-tuple sum over the integers of this thing. So it's some specialization of g-dimensional Fourier series with very specific Fourier coefficients given right here. Okay. So Z is a g-dimensional complex vector, and this matrix B, which parameterizes this theta function, is referred to as a Riemann matrix. A Riemann matrix is defined as a symmetric matrix. So transpose is equal to itself, and the imaginary part has to be positive definite. So it's very easy to write down a Riemann matrix, any old Riemann matrix. As it turns out, not all of these give you solutions of KP or of integrable equation in general. It's only certain classes of these that are much harder to get at that give you solutions. Now, from the definition I just gave you, it's not obvious to just calculate functions of this to just calculate values of this function. When I put g equal 1 and I only have one sum, then everything reduces to elliptic functions, and that function theta is just a third of the Jacobi theta functions. And Whitaker and Watson already tell you what the best way is to compute that. But if you go to G higher than 1, then you get into a lot of computational trouble for one thing. In every imaginary direction that you have, the function has exponential growth and so on. So these are issues to deal with. And they can be dealt with. That was a previous talk. It's a function of many variables. Factoring out the exponential growth, here's various slices of a g equals 2 theta function. So depending on which slice of the, let's see, for a genus 2 theta function, you'd have a function of 4 real variables, so of 2 complex variables. What you're looking at, the function itself is complex. What you're looking at is real, imaginary, and absolute value of the function for various arguments. Okay, but so it's a function that has a lot of different faces, and you might want to believe that some of these might be helpful in describing water waves. Okay. Back to this slide. Previous projects have allowed us to compute theta. Just hope I convince you of that with the slide. So we can now compute theta. and we can compute the B's that actually matter for these equations. Usually when I talk on this topic, I end with a demo because, well, one, I can show you spectacular pictures of theta functions, or I can show you a Riemann matrix, and that's not that spectacular, but it's supposed to be symmetric according to the theory, which we don't put in the program. So when it comes out to be symmetric, that's at least something you can see by looking at a computer screen. The Abel transform that I'm going to talk about today, I put in a few numbers and out come a few numbers, and I figure it wasn't worth the demo. But if somebody wants to see the demo at work, and not only of the Abel transform but of anything else, I can still do that after the talk. Everything I'm going to say in the rest of the talk will deal with this. I'm going to talk about phi. How do you get phi? This phase factor. So what's phi? Well, it's different for different integrable equations. For Kp, it's this. For Kp, it's given as the Abel transform of some divisor d, and then I'm going to subtract the vector of Riemann constants. So I just translated the problem into a different problem. I don't have time to go in all the technical details of what the Abel transform does and what the Riemann constants are. I hope that I have time enough to tell you what the Abel transform is, tell you what the Riemann constants are, and what the main difficulties are in computing them and how you solve those difficulties without getting technical. This formula holds for Kp. If you have any other integrable equation, the Abel transform and the Riemann constants will still be vital ingredients in there, but the formula could change slightly. But the Abel transform and the Riemann constants are always required to get this phase information for various equations. Okay, I will assume that not everybody knows what, for instance, Nick Arcolani knows about Riemann surfaces. Stop me if I'm wrong. I mean, if everybody knows Riemann surfaces, then... So I recently found a reference to I think 1950s Dover book on algebraic curves where the author starts off by assuming that mentioning Riemann surfaces will not cause a heart attack. I will use the same assumption. Okay, so let gamma be some compact connected Riemann surface. When I say that, I think of a polynomial in two variables equated to zero. So any Riemann surfaces can be represented in this way if you're willing to allow, well, really any polynomial in two variables. So the way to think of this is think of lambda, which occurs to some degree in this polynomial equation, as a multivalued function of mu. Just to get my vocabulary straight, let's think of mu as a multivalued function of lambda. It doesn't really matter. So you vary lambda, and that will give you different values of mu depending on the degree of the polynomial in mu, and so that corresponds to different sheets, different versions of the lambda plane that need to of the mu plane that need to be glued together, and when you do all of that pasting together, that's the Riemann surface. The Riemann surface only has one topological invariant, that is the genus, which is essentially the number of holes in this thing. Okay, so I've drawn a genus 2 Riemann surface. And if you have G holes in the surface, what I'm going to do next is I'm going to integrate things that are holomorphic everywhere. On the Riemann sphere, so in the extended complex plane, there is no such thing except, well, that's essentially Liouville's theorem. But from the moment that you have holes, there are such things. Now, if you're integrating something that's holomorphic everywhere, then you know by Cauchy's theorem that you can always deform your cycles. So if I put a cycle here and a cycle here, and then I draw a cycle that goes around both holes, for integration purposes, that's just a sum of this and that. So I can break everything down and just talk about a few basic cycles. And the ones that we need are the ones around the holes and the ones around the arms. I'll call those A and B cycles. So again, for the Riemann sphere, there are no things that are holomorphic everywhere. There are no differentials that are holomorphic everywhere. If you have a genus G surface, then there are G linearly independent such differentials. So now there are things to integrate. So we have these 2G integration paths. All of this information together, these differentials and these integration paths on the surface, give us the matrix B that was in the formula for KP. That gives us a theta function at this point. It gives us the vector K, L, and very much an abusive notation. This omega is not related to these. This was the frequency vector in my formula. It gives us these, and it gives us that constant C that's up front. Okay? The phase vector phi requires more information. It requires this divisor D, which is, it's usually written as a formal sum of G points on the surface. Okay? This information up here, together with this, gives me the phase vector. I'm not going to show you how that happens. That is almost 30 years old now. Work of Krzyzewer and Novikov and so on. I just want to go over how you could actually compute these things. So the divisor is a formal sum of G points on a surface. For my purposes, it's really just a set of G points, sometimes counting multiplicities. All right. Okay, so now we already know, there were three things on that slide that we needed to know. We needed to know what a divisor was, a set of G points. We needed to know what the Abel transform was, and we needed to know what the Riemann constants were. One down. What is the Abel transform? Okay. The Abel transform takes a point on the Riemann surface, and it maps it to the Jacobian of the Riemann surface. The Jacobian of the Riemann surface is nothing but the CG modded by the period lattice of the the theta function, so modded out by integer vector n plus 2 pi I. Here's the matrix B again, dotted with an integer vector m. So this is a G-complex dimensional torus. Okay, and it's referred to as the Jacobian of the Riemann surface. And it's relatively straightforward to see that if I define the Abel transform, the kth component of the Abel transform as taking a point on the Riemann surface and just integrating one of my holomorphic differentials from some fixed threshold point to the point P, then that's going to map me to the Jacobian to this torus right here. Okay? So that's what the Abel transform does, is it takes points on the surface and it maps them by using them as integration points. It maps them to the Jacobian. So that's the Abel transform of a single point. We needed the Abel transform of the divisor. That's just a sum. You have an Abel transform of a divisor with 3 points in it, and you just add up 3 Abel transforms. So what we need is we need to find out how to compute the Abel transform of a single point. Now, that requires us to integrate on the Riemann surface. Let's assume that we know how to get these holomorphic differentials. Again, that was obtained previously. So I should probably explain what I mean by obtained previously. So what I've been doing, amongst other things, the last few years is I've been writing these algorithms and implementing them in Maple, that if you want to get the holomorphic differentials corresponding to a Riemann surface that you get from your favorite polynomial in two variables, you just press enter. I mean, you write differentials, your favorite polynomial, you specify the variables, and you press enter, and there's your list of differentials. So when I say we know how to get these differentials, I mean, you know how to get it. I mean, these are black box algorithms. It's essentially making these problems rather trivial. Now, so the same thing goes for this matrix B that we've obtained before. And to get this matrix B, that actually also requires integration on the Riemann surface. So that shows that in the past we've known how to integrate on the Riemann surface. So what's the problem? That's all that the Abel transform required. Well, before what we needed, we knew which paths to use. There were just paths on the Riemann surface, and there was no problem with that. And the main thing was that when you take these different sheets, mu of lambda, and put them together to get the Riemann surface, then So there's things like branch points. And because of the representation that I'm allowing for the remote surface, there could be singular points. So a branch point is a point that when you encircle it, you end up on a different sheet. Okay, so branch points are gateways between sheets, and we'll actually need them later. Singular points, however, are much more of a nuisance. So at singular points, some of the sheets could join as well, but going around a singular point doesn't get you anywhere else. It doesn't bring you to a different sheet. Okay, now all the integration happens with analytic continuation. So you're on a certain sheet, and now you want to get you want to integrate to a different lambda value, but you want to stay on the same sheet. You do that by analytic continuation numerically, and that works very well. It's not exactly fast, but it works well. But before, in order for all the integration that we needed to do before, we could stay away from all these problem points. We stayed away from all the points where the sheets merged. So numerically, there was no trouble with this. So here, to calculate the Abel transform, there are two significant problems. One is, you give me an initial point P0, so beginning point P0 and an end point P, how do you get from P0 to P? That's one question. And the second question is, a lot of times in the applications, especially P0, the beginning point, turns out to be a problem point. It turns out to be the point at infinity often, or one of the branch points. So we don't have this luxury of being able to avoid these points. They're really part of the problem. So how do we find these integration paths? Well, the first thing to note is that how you go from P0 to P, how you go from this initial reference point to this final point P, as long as you figure out one way to do that, that's fine. So the Abel transform is path independent. So it's just a question of finding one way. So here's the typical scenario. You could have a four-sheeted surface, and I have sheet 1 over here, sheet 2 over here, sheet 3, sheet 4. For instance, if I wanted to go from sheet 4 to sheet 3, well, I can't just do that because sheet 4 and sheet 3 could not be connected the way I've defined my sheets. But the whole Riemann surface is connected, so I may have to go through another sheet to get there. In this case, to go from sheet 1 to sheet 4, sheet 1 and sheet 4 are not connected in this picture. I have to go through sheet 2, then to sheet 3, and then through sheet 4. Okay? So it becomes a combinatorial problem in terms of figuring out which sheets, which branch points you can use to go from one sheet to another sheet, and then just kind of navigating your way around. It becomes a combinatorial problem. I wrote a big combinatorics problem, but the people who do combinatorics would probably laugh at this. But that's the main issue there. So essentially, you construct a huge matrix that tells you which sheet allows you to get to another sheet, and then just kind of navigate with that. How do we deal with the problem points? Well, so this actually confused me for quite a bit. My background is not on Riemann surfaces, and so when I started doing this, I just kind of followed some of my favorite papers on the subject. And when they talk about the Abel transform, they never mention that it depends on the matrix B. And it does, in fact, depend on the matrix B quite heavily. If you back up there. So the matrix B determines the image of the Abel map. But see, one of the things I was trying to do is I figured, well, if something is a branch point, when I look at mu as a covering of the lambda plane, as mu as a function of lambda, if it's a branch point, then, hey, if I look at lambda as a function of mu, that's the same Riemann surface. So why don't I do that? Because now it's not going to be a branch point anymore. That unfortunately doesn't work because your Jacobian will be different. That is because you've normalized, see there's just a unit matrix up front here, that's because you've normalized your differentials to do that. The differentials that go in here are normalized so that there is a unit matrix here. Okay, if that didn't happen, you could actually do that, but that possibility has been taken away. So there's a little bit more work required. And so the idea is we're going to use Pissarro series. Pissarro series are very useful for us They are the things that allow us to look at any polynomial in two variables, even if there's singular points involved. So these differentials omega k, they are holomorphic everywhere, including at the branch points and including at the singular points. So if I have a local representation, if I know what the surface looks like close to the singular point, so I've got a series expansion for mu as a function of lambda, I can plug that into differential omega k. And then essentially what I'll do is I'll go, instead of going from p0 to p, which is my singular point, I'll go from p0 to p hat, using what I usually do, just because I'm staying away from any problem points. And then to get this last part, I'll more or less use an expansion method to do this part analytically. Okay, because the differential itself will be fine. The differential itself will have a constant term and then some higher order terms, but it's not going to have any singularities, so that integration has no problems at all. All right. There's one problem with this. If you do this for branch points, that's okay. For a branch point, so if this is a genus 2 Riemann surface, a branch point is just a point on the surface, just like any other point. The fact that it's a branch point is a consequence of your representation. For a singular point, however, now if I, so really a Riemann surface is a manifold, so I should get rid of a singular point. If you get rid of the singular point, you just kind of tear these apart, and the singular point corresponds to two different places on your Riemann surface, whereas the branch point doesn't. Okay, so if you have a singular point, then, so there's going to be different PC expansions near that singular point, and you will have to specify which one to use. That makes the user interaction a little bit more complicated, in that you won't be able to turn it into a black box where there's no more user input required. If the user gives a single point as one of the points P or P0, there will have to be either the PC expansion will have to be specified or the user will have to be prompted for it, which is a little bit annoying. Last point. What is the Riemann constant vector? Well, I'll just draw up the definition. Here it is. It actually depends on a fixed reference point, which shows up right here. Here's something we already can calculate. And then there's this annoyance. This annoyance is a double integral on the Riemann surface. If you're doing any integration on the Riemann surface with analytic continuation, the last thing you want to do is a double integral, because it's going to be horrendously slow. And so we already have this working, but it's so horrendously slow that, I mean, there's no way we want to use it. And so we're actually finding ways around dealing with this analytic continuation. We still have to use analytic continuation to some extent, but we're finding ways that we can simplify this, because this is just too messy, too costly. Okay. So if I want to get at these solutions of these integrable equations, what do I need? I need the Riemann matrix, check. I need the theta function, check. Abel transform, almost check. I need the Riemann constant vector, check, but slow, but almost check for faster. Faster is still slow, but it's a lot better. These are all the ingredients that are required for all of these different integrable equations that that you may be interested in. ODEs, discrete, continuous one-dimensional, two-dimensional, and so on. After that, it gets interesting, because now you can start to look at specific equations. If you want to do KdV, there's a specific recipe to get KL, omega, and C. You want to do Sine-Gordon, there's different recipes to get these things. You want to do Abelard Sladek as a semi-discrete model, there's different ways to get these things. So after this, it becomes equation-specific, and all the general ingredients have been settled. So that's the next step. The last thing I'll put up is, maybe you don't care about integral equations at all. I found an application for Riemann surfaces in the entertainment industry, and clearly the entertainment industry has much more grant money than anybody else. So I'll stop at that. I don't take any questions. Thank you.